You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
Tonight's guest, Nicole Mason, is author of Born Bright, a young girl's journey from nothing to something in America. A longtime Ms. Magazine scholar, she's also a widely published writer, mother of two young children, and has taught at Spelman College and New York University. She currently serves as the executive director of the Center for Research and Policy in the Public Interest at the New York Women's Foundation. Mason has known Karen Jolna, our moderator for tonight's conversation, through their collaborative work at Ms., which is a publication of the Feminist Majority Foundation. At Ms. Magazine, Karen Jolna is the program director and editor of Ms. in the Classroom. She served as a research scholar at the UCLA Center for the Study of Women for 11 years and developed and taught one of the first women and leadership courses. As an LA resident for all of my adult years, I consider myself well-versed in the city's geography and pretty savvy when it comes to navigating the immensity that is Los Angeles. But do I really know LA's neighborhoods, the people who live in them, and the many worlds existing within? Do you? Save for a few volunteer opportunities that have taken me into neighborhoods I'd otherwise probably not venture to on my own, my honest answer is a no. In Nicole Mason's deeply personal and courageous book, Born Bright, she takes the reader into her world, to her houses in Compton, Inglewood, and San Bernardino. Her powerful storytelling shows how the lack of access to opportunities, resources, and vital networks impacts poor people. Mason gives the reader an opportunity to understand the racism and poverty that shaped her world, one in which, unfortunately, far too many others are also living at this very moment, just blocks away from the library. Mason's story really woke me up to this moment, to the crisis we are in, and to knowing there is so much more we can all do. And when I say woke up, that's beyond already feeling woken up by this troublesome national moment we are living. Nicole Mason's voice is brave, bold, and compelling. She has told an insider story, summoning the voice of the little girl she once was, and complementing that voice with the reflection and insight of someone who managed, quite remarkably, to step out of her circumstances against extreme odds. And so on the heels of an immensely positive and radical coming together of millions of people worldwide this past weekend for the Women's March, to hear Nicole Mason's story tonight, gathered together in a public library, is one small step to better understanding and learning how, together, we can take action. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished guests to the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library.
Thank you, Maureen, for that great introduction, and I just want to say I'm thrilled to be here tonight. And on behalf of Ms. Magazine, thank you so much to the Library Foundation board, staff, and the Aloud staff, and everyone who is involved in this program, from Louise to Maureen to the president, Ken Brescher, and Judy Kamens, and Nadia Lawden, and Carla Christofferson. Just thank you so much for making tonight happen. And thank you all for making this a special evening at the Library Foundation with our extraordinary guest, Dr. Nicole Mason, who braved weather on both coasts and flight cancellations to be here. And I'm also under the weather from the march on the weekend, so all I can say is onward. So the spotlight tonight is on the power of storytelling to achieve great and good change in this new political world, a tumultuous, power-shifting, and dangerous world. And one of the things we want to talk about is who gets to tell these stories. And that question is more important than ever now. And we want to talk about why there are so few women memoirs by Black women being written today, too. So we're going to touch on that. And Dr. Nicole Mason's new memoir, Born Bright, A Young Girl's Journey from Nothing to Something in America, is actually one of only a few memoirs by Black women in the last couple of years. And Nicole is also, can I call you Nicole?
Yes, of course.
We're actually friends as well. Nicole is also one of those rare storytellers who can connect the dots between her personal story and the political and social world around her. So I think this is going to be a great evening. I have so many questions for you. But first, I know that Nicole and I and many of you in the audience here attended the women's marches last Saturday. So I was going to say a show of hands. That's great. So I thought we would start off by talking about what it means for, and this is our current count at Ms. Magazine, for 3.5 million to 5 million is the span that we're looking at right now, and the count is still on, women and men to show up and march in, the other count is over 700 cities in the U.S. and globally. It's considered right now one of the biggest one-day protests both in the U.S. and the world. So, Nicole, I want to give you the first question. As someone who has focused your research and organized around Black women and girls your entire life, could you tell us what that day, what the march meant to you?
So, I attended the march in Washington, D.C., and I have seven-year-old twins, and so I took them with me because I thought it was really important for them to witness. I wasn't sure what was going to happen, how big the march was going to be, but I wanted them to be there, and there was a lot of conversation leading up to the march and when we got there, and they said, "Do we hate Donald Trump?" You know, because the signs, it looked like everybody hated Donald Trump. And I said, no, we don't hate Donald Trump. We're here to stand up for our values and to stand up for our rights and to make sure that we can all be equal. In very plain language that they could understand. And they said, okay. And so my daughter made a video, and I said, well, why are you here at the march? And she said, because, you know, I'm here with my family and my friends, and we're here to stand up for equality. So she really got it by the end of the mm-hmm. march why we were there. And I felt, I didn't, obviously, again, I'm a conspiracy theorist. I got no cell service on while I was out there. And so, you know, hey, it could have been 10 million. We don't know, you know. And when I did finally make contact with someone, and they said it's really huge, and it's on the TV, and they said that it's growing and it's all over the country, and I really felt very hopeful in that moment because I knew that this was the beginning of resistance, and I felt that we're going to be okay despite what happened today. But I just I felt very hopeful.
And what about all of you? Did you feel hopeful? Yeah, me too. So at the same time, there have been a lot of critics of the march, and we talked a little bit about this both at dinner today and yesterday. And in fact, Nicole just wrote a Ms. blog piece giving her response to some of the criticisms of the march. So do you want to share with us what you said in the blog and some of your, she gave some rules for marching.
Oh, so yeah, some rules for what to do. Well, obviously there's been, you know, this is how we struggle together. This is how we build movements. There's questions, there's critics, there are people who show up. And one of the things that I thought from the very beginning is that even if I didn't agree about how the march came together or the origins, that I had to engage and be and show up and really have those hard conversations. And so I think the first rule was, I think the first rule that I wrote about, I said, you know, if you don't show up, you don't get to talk shit. That's just, like rule number one. And because, you know, there are a lot of people who sat on the, sidelines and, mm-hmm. you know, armchair critics. And I said, well, we can't afford that in this moment. And it's actually a real luxury to be able to do that, to pick and choose when you'll get off the sidelines and mobilize and resist. And in this political moment, I don't think we can afford those kinds of choices mm-hmm. Or opting out in that way. And I think I'm not going to go through all the rules, mm-hmm. but I think the other rule, well, maybe I'll say two, but the other one was we have to start showing up for one another. So, because yes, I think important. Some of the criticism was that, you know, where are you when we're marching for Black lives? Where are you when we're marching for immigrant, you know, for immigration reform and LGBTQ stuff? Like, where is everyone? You know, because obviously you're there, because we've seen that you 2 million people can show up to rally mm-hmm. around a particular set of issues. And so I think that I think I say in the article, the same tools that maintain sexism, racism, classism are the same tools that's maintaining patriarchy and some of these other forms of oppression. And so we need to make sure that we're making those connections. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be very constructive and not get on this bandwagon and be very dogmatic, but really talk about like, mm-hmm. hey, we have to show up. It's not easy, but we have to stay present and engaged. Mm-hmm. So
that's great. Thank you for that blog. You can go on the Ms. blog and see the rest of that. So now the big question becomes post-march, how to turn in that huge turnout into a lasting political, is that me? Political.
Nope. That's them.
Lasting political power. So how to transform that energy from that day into lasting political power. Do you have some first thoughts on that?
Well, I think we're going to continue to stay engaged. One of the things that was disheartening when I went home after the march was to turn on CNN and MSNBC and see really a sea of what seemed to me to be white men and a few women talking about, well, what does this mean anyway? Everybody's going to mm-hmm. go home. And I said, you couldn't find anybody else to talk about this? Because everybody's still at the march, you know? And I said, you know, I said, you're going to see. You're going to see. And I think the more things that continue to happen that are against our values, the more people will continue to show up. Mm-hmm. And I think it's my responsibility to engage my friends, even the ones who... Mm-hmm. have said, you know, I didn't march because whatever, to hold them accountable and say, this is not about you, that we have work to do. And you don't have to do what I do. You can do what you do. You can run for local office. You can do a mm-hmm. petition. You can march. But you have to do something. And we can all do more, mm-hmm. I think.
So. Now, I have a question for you that comes from your article in the New York Times. It's a recent article where Nicole was asked about the future of feminism. And I was just thrilled that you were part of that national conversation and wondered if you could share with us what that conversation was then and where do you think we should take that conversation about feminism now?
So... It was so the article was entitled Feminist Lost is question mark. So there was this questioning of whether or not feminism was dead. You know, it's always dying every few years. Yep. It just dies and resurrected because, you know, and it's not dead.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, can I actually just cut in to mention something about the feminism is dead? The Feminist Majority Foundation, where I work, who publishes Ms. Magazine, they were founded in the 1980s after a Time Magazine cover story, and I still remember seeing that where it said feminism is dead. And then the inside of that cover actually for the first time had a poll where the majority of women were feminists. So the cover didn't even match the story. And so the Feminist Majority Foundation was actually founded to voice that fact that feminist women are, you know, the majority of women are feminists and feminists are the majority. So just to, you know, and this conversation, like Nicole is just saying, just cycles around to this most recent
this question. Yeah. So I want to take it back. I want to connect it to the march again.
Okay.
So some of the things that we're struggling with in feminism are the questions that always remain, right? So women and girls have not achieved parity, so we're always struggling and fighting for those things. And within the feminist movement, there are some tension between white women, women of color, poor women, like whose feminism is it? Mm-hmm. And how inclusive should we be? Should we be intersectional? What should the agenda look like? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I say in the article in the blog, mm-hmm. and I'm saying now, is that for all of my life, or not all of my life, first of all, I'm not that old, but for, and I've, you know, when I came into feminism, so I would say I've been a feminism for about 2 decades now, mm-hmm. so about 20 years now. And so these questions I've been struggling with these questions for quite some time. But what is true, and what I said about the march, I said, you know, I don't care if 1.5 million white women showed up. There were 3 women of color who led that march. And so they answered the call, and they were led by those women. And so for all the talk about building a more inclusive feminist movement where it's women of color are at the center and are leading and organizing, that happened at the march, and we cannot mm-hmm. deny that. Mm-hmm. And so I just, you know, so we have made progress. Now, what I did say, I was talking to Judy at the table, what was disheartening was that the dais, at least in Washington, D.C., was full of trans women, queer women, women of color, white women, all of us talking together and engaging and bridge building and connecting issues. What you saw in the news was a completely different story. Mm-hmm. White women were talking about the march. I saw in L.A. some man who just opened up his balcony got to talk about the march. It's like, how did this guy get in on this? You know, I mean, he had very little to say. He just said, well, you know, it's a lot of people, and I just, you know, wonder where were they 2 months ago. I was like, this guy, you know. So I would appreciate, but that wasn't because we did that. The march did not do that.
Right.
That's what the media did about the march. And so they wanted to make it and turn it into this thing that it really was not. And it made it smaller when it was really mm-hmm. this, you know, big effort. And it was led by a diverse group of women.
Mm-hmm. And the pictures they could not deny of just the sheer
number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
was great. That was beautiful. So you have called to continue the conversation on feminism. I know you've identified as a black feminist and also as a badass feminist. Do you want to tell us a little more about that?
Well, I identify as a black feminist and a badass feminist. And I just, when I came into feminism, I was reading a lot. You know, so I feel like I was made by black feminists like Alice Walker and Toni Morrison and Angela Davis and Paula, Patricia Hill Collins, and a lot of black feminist theorists that I read when I was coming into feminism. Mm-hmm. But at the time, and I think we were talking about this as well, and we can talk about Hillary and the loss, but Miss Magazine was very critical for me in terms of my own development. I remember I was volunteering at a battered women's shelter, and I remember sitting there with another friend of mine dreaming about, this is a true story, dreaming about writing for Miss Magazine. And we were also going to do, I don't know, we were 19. I mean, what we thought we were going to do a lot of stuff. We're going to write feminist textbooks. We were going to just do all this kind of stuff. And so it's just come really full circle to be here with you and to be in Miss Magazine and thinking about those early experiences that shaped my consciousness. And so knowing that we still have a lot of work to do, but understanding that we've come so far. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I wanted to say about this is that what I'm saddened by is the demise of strong feminist organizations mm-hmm. nationally, mm-hmm. like the National Organization for Women. There was other organizations, even the Feminist Majority, mm-hmm. But there were some other feminists, the National Black Feminist Organization, you know, a lot of feminist organizations that are not as strong as they were mm-hmm. 10 or 20 years ago. And I think that that's a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, have the lack of strong right. feminist centered institutions. And I'm not dismissing issue-based organizations like reproductive rights organizations or choice right. organizations.
I think that's what I also saw change in the course of the march. The marches started off with individuals posting on Facebook, and then brought in a more diverse and some of our key feminist leaders. And then the next stage was actually, and that's how we got involved, where they actually reached out to the major national feminist organizations. And I would actually say that that was part of this kind of thing is very hard to organize. I know what I saw at the Feminist Majority Foundation for weeks before, helping, giving that long-term advice on how you actually organize a march and get the people together, get the, you know, everything going. And both drawing on that experience and those networks of people. And then for us going to the march, we also saw ahead where this can't be one day. People can't just show up and then go home. So this is how I lost my voice. We brought petitions and action alert sign-ups for people to stay involved. And this was all the national organizations coming together and sharing lists to sign up. And we're all compiling them now, so that we can literally organize that new movement and bolster these organizations. So I think that that's going to be one of the strengths going forward, that we have this base of national organizations behind this new
movement.
Yeah. So one of the questions we've been getting all week at Ms. Magazine and Feminist Majority is, how do we get involved as individuals, and what's next? So part of that is getting involved with organizations, and what are some other ideas that you can offer us for getting involved, staying involved, being active, especially if you haven't been active before?
Well, I think that act locally,
yeah.
you know, so in your homes and in your communities. And like, so one of the things I learned about from this election mm-hmm. is that we're not having conversations outside of our family or friends or Facebook feed. And that's dangerous. And when everybody, we should all be doing our work in our own communities, mm-hmm. in our own way. Mm-hmm. So white people talking to white people about race and class and about why this is important. You know, if I'm if you, Karen, are really liberal, but you know that when you go home for Thanksgiving and your sister is a Republican or your father is a Republican, like how do you, That's who you should be talking to. Yeah. Don't come in my community telling me, you know, what, let's talk, you know, because those are the harder conversations to have. Those are the more difficult ones, like, you know. And so, I have in my family, you know, people who voted for Trump as well. So I don't want to sort of, you know, excuse my family, you know, crazy people there too, you know. Okay. it was hard to have those conversations with them as well about why are you voting for Trump? Like, really, why are you voting for Trump? And so I think that there's a lot of work that we need to do as community, you know, like, with one another, but also the work that we need to do within our families and our really intimate circles about, you know, the stuff that we need to heal or work through or really, you know, talk about. So that's where I start. And I just think that, and this is related to Born Bright a little bit, but everything, so I'll say this. After the day after the election, I was emotionally devastated, you know. I was very upset. And I was like, this is really horrible. And then the next morning when I got up, I said, how is my life going to change? Turns out it didn't change that much. I woke up, got coffee, got my kids dressed, got myself dressed, went to the gym, and went on to work. My day looked the very same way that it does pretty much every other day. And that's dangerous, you know. And what I said to myself is that, for the most part, because of the comfort that I have, my life is probably not going to change that much. You know, I have citizenship status. Mm-hmm. I, you know, have a job. My kids go to a good school. So Davos? You know, like, she, you know, we're going to be fine.
Yeah.
Mike Pence was my neighbor just recently. He's moved out. He's moved on. You know, we had the dance party. In our neighborhood. And so my neighborhood is very, you know, I have all the things. I live in a very connected community. So it's comfortable. I don't have to leave it. But I need to leave it. I need to go to the, about 2 miles away where there is a real threat. And so I need to get outside of my community. So I really think that you don't even have to go far to connect. You can just really go maybe a mile away from where you live to really connect.
Yeah. And that's very true here in Los Angeles too. And we'll talk a little bit about your book, which is Growing Up in America, but it's also Growing Up Right Here in Los Angeles. And so now let's turn to your memoir. And first, though, I know you're going to do a reading for us, but first I just wanted to ask you a couple of general questions to pick up on what we were talking about. Why are there so few memoirs by Black women that get national attention and acclaim? There are definitely memoirs out there, but they're not getting the attention and the media attention and the acclaim that you've gotten.
Well,
and congratulations, by the way.
Debatable. Yeah. I'm kidding. I think that, so there's a couple of things. So the book didn't start off as a memoir. It started off as a public policy book. So I'm a policy person. The agent was shopping the book around, and there was the publisher, St. Martin's Press. So the New Press and St. Martin's Press responded around the same time. Yeah. And they both had very disparate reactions. So the New Press person said she wanted straight policy books. She didn't want any narrative. She didn't want to hear my story at all. And the St. Martin's person said, you didn't write a lot about your narrative, but there was one sentence that I read about your family, and I think you should write a memoir instead. Mm. And I said, I had no idea, you know. So she said, and so to sell it, she said, I think it'd be easier because it's your story. And I was like, yeah, you're right, it would be easier. It was not. It was not. And so that's how it became a memoir instead of a public policy book or very, you know, empirical, objective. Mm-hmm. book. And I think that it's rare for a Black woman to be both the subject and the storyteller. Usually we're one or the other. So somebody's either telling a story about us mm-hmm. or we're writing about somebody else. And so the story is not necessarily being told through our eyes. And I'm not interpreting the facts. So mm-hmm. I think what's really great about Born Bright is that I get to do both. Mm-hmm. And I get to, you know, lean in and tell this story and then step back and have this analysis of my experiences and the experiences of my family and my community. So, you know, so I think that's a good thing. And there's been, you know, over the last 10 years, there's maybe been, or 20 years, I'd say 10 to 20 years, maybe about 5 memoirs by Black women, and many of them are by well-known women, so like bell hooks or, mm-hmm. You know, Maya Angelou, Oprah's writing a memoir now, I think, but people who are well-known. So mm-hmm. it was really, for me to be able to have the opportunity, somebody says, we want to hear your story, even though nobody knows you from Adam or Eve or whoever, you know, was really, I think, special. And there's also been a proliferation of memoirs by Black men, mm-hmm. You know, just in a different city. It's really kind of the same story, but like, you know, in Baltimore, and then this guy in, you know, I don't know, LA, you know. and so what I'm hoping is that Born Bright opens the door for many more stories like this to be told. Mm-hmm. And really ask why aren't these stories allowed to be told in a significant way?
Okay. You mentioned learning some more about the response to your book on your book tour. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've heard about the response? And you've also heard some things about why people say that they might not relate.
Yeah, so
which is surprising. Yeah.
You know, I think I've gotten the book has gotten a lot of really great response. Mm-hmm. So what I like most is that when people read it and they see themselves in the mm-hmm. book. So when Black women specifically, you know, even though they may not have had the same experience, they say, I understand, or, you know, when your mother was combing your hair, I know that experience because my mother combed my hair the same way. And, you know, I also think it's a very human story. So mm-hmm. when other people read it, or, you know, men read it or white women read it, they also can empathize with little Nicole and going hungry, mm-hmm. or they've had a similar experience and they can see themselves as well. And I also think it's a broader story about constrained choices. So we always imagine ourselves making the right choice. But what if your back was against the wall? Would you make that same choice? Or if you had very little, what choice would you make? And so I think it asks these larger meta questions about decisions, life paths, you know, what would you do in a similar situation? Mm-hmm.
So it's also showing publishers now.
Well, hopefully. Yeah. We'll see, you know. you know, St. Martin's Press is really generous mm-hmm. with me in terms of letting me tell the story how I saw mm-hmm. fit. They didn't say, you know, we want for you to tell the story in this way or sensationalize it. And one of the things that's been really hard in terms of the reception is that people already think they know the story mm-hmm. because it's a story that people tell all the time about Black people or Black girls and about poverty. And I said, you know, I can tell who's read the book because I'm like, you didn't read the book.
Right.
And it's fine. Yeah. You know, like we all have things to do, you know. literally, I can sit with a person and who's interviewing me and they've not read the book, you know.
Yeah.
And it's fine, you know. But like I've had just a really quick story about I won't say the, because this is a podcast, so I'm not going to say the magazine. But there was a magazine that ran a story, and I had been getting galleys of the book for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I was actually over reading the book and excerpts of the book. So they said, well, we just need you to look at this story, this excerpt, mm-hmm. and then then we'll just, you know, approve it and print it. And I don't know what made me read it, because I was just going to sign off on it. And I read it, and what they did was they took every salacious detail in the book and mashed it up. And it looked like a pathological, I mean, it just was just the worst thing that, I mean, I was like, oh my God. And so I say, you know, you can't print this, you know, because it's not true. It's not true the way you are representing it. And somebody, they wrote back and they said, well, we think it's wonderful. like, and, you know, so I was just like, look, I don't know. I just don't want my friends to read this and people to read this and think that this is, like, I'm doing this to my family and my community. And it was really, you know, they changed it. So I will say that, they changed it. But I was like, what if I'd been a different person and hadn't had my feminist principles, my racial politics? It could have just gone on in this way. And so that has been the toughest thing to manage, I think, the way the story is presented and out in the world and how people interpret the story.
And it's surprising, I know, with the Ms. Magazine excerpt that you all have in this issue.
It wasn't Ms. Magazine.
It wasn't Ms. Magazine. Just saying. That it was surprising, because I was working with the editor on our excerpt, how much construction actually goes into an excerpt, pulling out and how you can make this the truth of the story and make it an entirely different story. That was really surprising for me. I thought you just sort of pulled an excerpt out of a book.
Yeah,
so
no,
that
it's
was a learning
whole,
experience.
Which I didn't know either. I thought they were going to do that too. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know? And, but so, I mean, it's great, but it's that, I think that's in terms of reception is the most, was the hardest thing.
So one of the things I love so many parts of your book. One of the things I love most was how, like you said, you told the story, which part of the story is an American that they, on first look, and if you haven't read the book, it is an American sex success story. It's inspirational, and you in many ways did pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and I know you've said you pretty much saved yourself, but you go so much broader when you read the book and deeper and tell the counter narrative of the American dream story, which is that most people in your neighborhood and neighborhoods like yours do not make it out. And in fact, the truth is, and I was shocked at that statistic, that it's 4% of folks get out of poverty and make it to a middle class life, when that so-called usual American success story tells us that everyone can get out if they just work hard enough and do everything. So my first question about that, of how you hold both together, is I've just always been intrigued by the title of your book, Born Bright, Young Girls from Nothing to Something. So clearly you didn't mean you were nothing before and you're something, and clearly you didn't mean that everyone who didn't make it out is nothing. Can you tell me more about all the layers of that,
well,
that title and what that meant to you, or did the editor, you know, how it came to be?
Well, Born Bright was like
share that.
So I really wanted to, so when I was thinking about the title, I wanted a title that was not, did not have poverty in the title, because nobody wants to read about poverty. Like, I was very clear that a book on poverty, it's like nobody's buying it.
Yeah.
And so, and I wanted to capture this idea that we all are born with the same potential, and, you know, kind of challenge this idea of American exceptionalism, where, you know, there's one bright person, and that's the reason why they make it out of extraordinary circumstances, is because they are exceptional or superhuman. And this idea that it's the things that happen along the way that dim the light or extinguish the fire or destroy the will, you know, mm-hmm. of the person. And it happens very early on. So that is Born Bright. Now, the subtitle, Young Girl's Journey, we liked the Young Girl's Journey. Yep. From Nothing to Something, people didn't really like, you know, like we had some debate around it, but mm-hmm, then it was time to publish and we just went with this title to be perfect. That's how it happened.
Right.
But
right.
really wanted to make it a story. Like it really was like this idea, which we all, this American dream story where, you mm-hmm. know, you start with very little and you right, end up winning right. big, you know, in life. But I think what's really interesting about the story is that that's not the story that I'm telling.
Right.
You know, I'm not, it's not a pat yourself on the back, self-congratulatory, look at you, you made it and you didn't. It's about why was I the only one, mm-hmm. you know? And I say in the book and, you know, and I've had the question a lot for myself, you know, there are so many kids in my neighborhood who were much smarter than me and capable, but for a lot of different reasons didn't have the same chances or opportunity that I had mm-hmm. and are not here. So there could, you know, and I wanted to explain in the book, like why some do and others don't make it to the other side of the tracks. Mm-hmm. And I think that story, I felt like that was missing. Like we needed an intervention because there are a lot of stories about if you work hard enough, you'll make it out. So what that means is that if you don't make it, you are either lazy. This is the, you know, mm-hmm. again, you're lazy. You know, there's some pathology going on. You know, and I just want to say that's not true. And I know because I'm there. And so mm-hmm. the last thing I'll say about this, and this is just my academic hat, is that as a policy person, usually most of the people talking about policy and poverty are white men. Sound mm-hmm. familiar? Reproductive rights is white men. and so they have all these ideas about, you know, what poor people are doing or not doing to help themselves, what kind of programs would work, and none of them work. They've never talked to any poor people ever in life, you know. And so, and often when I'm in the room, I'm like one of maybe the only or one of a few people of color saying, hey, there's something wrong with this, or hey, and I'll when I read the excerpt from the book, it's mm-hmm. just like, people don't know, you know, because they assume like, obviously we're, you know, you're here in the room with us, so you must come from where we come from. And, you know, having to disrupt that mm-hmm. Is really, you know, puts me in a vulnerable position, because I could just mm-hmm. sit and just say, okay, you're right, you know, that's why, I guess more programs, I guess they just don't want to get up and go to work, you know, or whatever. But I think writing Born Bright was also calling out that thing that happens where mm-hmm. people who are not directly impacted by an issue are making decisions about people that they know nothing about.
Which is why you have to change the narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
So will you give us the honor of reading a couple of the passages that we're talking about right now? It's a great setup, The Reckoning.
The Day of Reckoning.
Yeah. And a couple of your favorite parts of the book, please.
Yes. Well, you know, the whole book is my favorite part of the book, but I'm going to, you know, pick and choose here. Okay, so this is me. This is little Nicole. I know this picture I hated it until they were like, you don't have one picture? I was like, I have nothing. So this is little Nicole, and I'm going to just read from the very beginning. And the chapter is called, What Do You Want to Be? I got to school early and found Miss Ward in our empty classroom erasing the chalkboard and shuffling papers at her desk. I never had a conversation with her that was not related to an assignment, so I crept to my desk, pulled out a book, and began to read silently, hoping she would not notice me. Miss Ward, a brawny woman with silver wires in her mouth, was my second grade teacher at Abbott Elementary. a predominantly Black and Latino school in Linwood, California. Whenever we misbehaved, her voice rolled like thunder and bounced off the walls. My sole purpose in class, besides trying to impress her with my reading skills, was to keep from getting my ear twisted and my arm pinched, or being told to stand next to her desk while she continued to teach as if I were a lamppost. In horror, I watched the other kids squirm as she grabbed hold of their body parts and lectured them about the need to follow directions, stay in their seats, or not to talk out of turn. It looked painful. "Chautauqua, come here," she said. "Oh no," I thought, "this is it. She's going to twist my ear for coming to school early." I knew I should have waited for the bell to ring. Now it was too late. I pushed my chair from underneath the desk and carried the book with me to the front of the classroom. "Where do you live?" she asked. "Down the street," I said, exhaling. Our little pink house at the foot of the cul-de-sac was not far from the school. I walked the short distance alone. "With who?" "My mother, my brother, and my grandfather." She continued to write in her grade book as I stood fully prepared to answer any questions she threw my way. To keep from getting pinched, I would tell her anything she wanted to know. She dropped her pen and looked up at me. "You're smart. Do you know that? What do you want to be when you grow up?" Her unblinking eyes were trained on mine. She wanted me to know, to understand what she was saying. I shrugged. No one had ever asked me that question before, and I did not have an answer. "It doesn't matter if you don't know now. You're a smart little girl, and you can go far. Just keep it up." I stood there, feet glued to the floor, waiting for her to say more, but she did not. She returned to her gray book. After a few moments, I retreated back to my desk. What did she mean, keep it up? Or that I could go far, I wondered. Go where? I remember my conversation with Miss Ward decades later when I came across a study revealing that when inner-city kids were asked to draw the world, they drew their immediate neighborhoods, the corner store, the local carryouts, and their houses. Conversely, when middle-class and affluent kids were asked to do the same, they drew countries such as China or those in Europe. I believe if I had been given the task of drawing the world as a young child, I would have drawn my neighborhood, too. That was my world, and I could not see beyond it.
That's great. Thank you.
So the day, this, I don't have a picture because it would just be a picture of me present day and you looking at me, so I figured this would be fine. The chandelier with its dangling diamond-shaped cut glass seemed brighter than usual as I looked up at it from the stage. I surveyed the audience consisting of the usual lot of do-gooders, social workers, politicians, and policy advocates. I jotted systems down in all caps and underlined it twice. The oversized room was elegant, the tables dressed in white linens, and it had good chairs, the ones with the cushiony carpet-like bottoms. I was there to talk about poverty. I had delivered some version of the same speech nearly a dozen times in the past year. I barely had to prepare. Each time I gave the talk, a polite applause circled the room, and I was flooded with invitations to speak at the next event. I knew just what to say not to ruffle any feathers. Stronger programs, more money, stricter rules, and the development of life skills for the impoverished. However, I was growing uneasy with the lie. What we were saying worked, did not. When my turn came, rather than give my usual spiel, I wondered about whether or not it was the systems that were broken rather than the people. I spoke about the need to examine the institutions and structures in society and in communities that impede rather than support self-sufficiency. Standing before the podium in my nicely tailored suit, I felt safe saying what I had been thinking for so long. I was the director of a research center at New York University's Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service. I felt comforted by my position and believed perhaps I would be heard. I was an authority. During the question and answer segment of the program, a woman stood and identified herself as a social worker employed at one of the many agencies scattered throughout the city. "This comment is for you, Dr. Mason," she said. While she agreed that the systems did need some tinkering, she opined that what was really missing from the equation was individual responsibilities and that people needed to help themselves. A flash of heat washed over my body as I realized she was talking about me. In that moment, I was transported back to the countless hours I spent as a child waiting for my mother for social services, in oversized rooms and unmarked city buildings. At the break of dawn, we rose to catch several buses, only to be told to come back on another day because we were missing some document or that our application was still under review. For their part, the social workers seemed contemptuous and treated us as if they were doing us a favor by allowing us to receive ration-sized aid. Indeed, we repeat the trip the following day. "That's not true," is all I could muster before a skinny white man with wiry glasses began to speak. "I agree with the woman over there," he said, pointing in the direction of the woman who had challenged me. "There are programs out there, and the women, I mean families, are not doing their part to better their situations. I see it every day." I scanned the room. The sea of white faces with specks of color here and there seemed to agree with them. There was no dissent, only stillness. My stomach turned as I shuffled my papers. My eyes darted across the panel for help. Was anybody else going to say something? Why hadn't I just stuck to my notes? When I did, everything went well, and the narrative remained intact, cohesive, and unquestioned. By narrative, I mean the stories we all have in our heads about the lives of poor people, their behavior, and the reason for their circumstances. In this forum, I was not only disrupting that narrative, but also challenging the financial investments, institutions, and structures predicated upon an understanding of seeing the poor as lazy, infantile, morally corrupt, and in need of direction and supervision. It was that narrative that consciously or subconsciously most of us in the room were responsible for perpetuating. I swallowed hard. I did the right thing. I'm the beneficiary of the many programs that we are talking about here today. I attended Head Start. I was involved in after-school programs. I'm the first in my family to graduate from high school, to attend college, to receive a PhD. By now, my voice was shaking, but I could not stop. I was having in public the private conversations I reserved for my first-generation Black and Latino colleagues who had also successfully navigated their way out of poverty and into the middle class, and who have a deep understanding of the journey from there to here. These people in this room were strangers. "But I'm only one person," I continued. "Growing up, I knew kids in my neighborhood who were smarter and more capable of me, and they didn't make it out. Many have been killed, gone to prison, or living hand-to-mouth, or otherwise on the margins of society. Should I blame them or the system that only allow a few of us to escape at a time?" The room was pregnant with silence. I couldn't take it back. I felt like an intruder and exposed. In these type of professional settings, my personal experiences with hunger, poverty, and episodic homelessness often go undetected. It's assumed that I'm just like everybody else, an advocate, a policy expert, or an academic. Typically, when a woman is invited to tell her story during these panels or meetings, it feels voyeuristic or slimy, like a performance. Her story has a perfect, predictable arc. She was lost, then found by one of the many social service agencies in the city. She changed her behavior, became a better mother, and although she struggles to make ends meet, is on her way to economic prosperity. Hallelujah, the end. Her story is meant to inspire, to whip up emotion, and to make people in the audience feel good about their work and themselves. It's not meant to challenge or change how we make policies or shift how poor people in our communities, our cities, or in the larger society are perceived. There's also a clear separation between her and the experts on the stage. They, not her, are deciding what should be done. Here I was, blurring that line. I was both the subject and the author of the matter. I had firsthand knowledge of the messiness of poverty and the feelings the poor internalize from birth, like the belief that our very existence is a burden on society. The collapse of this boundary made me uncomfortable. I had worked hard to disguise my beginning in life, from the decision to change my name during my first week of college to the effort of erasing words like "can't" and "finstigo" from my vocabulary. I had succeeded in creating the perfect, impenetrable middle-class mask. Now it was off. So,
thank you.
So, that's kind of heavy. I could share. I had another heavy piece actually, but I'm thinking maybe if we have time, I'll share a lighter, more inspirational piece. But because we're in LA, I wanted to share this piece about the Rodney King riots, and just I think it's actually quite appropriate for this moment that we're in. Mm-hmm. So I'll share this story. Black people's history began at slavery, Mr. Coon said from the front of the room. A hand shot up in the back of the room. It was biracial militant Brad. he wore his hair curly in a picked-out afro and had piercing hazel green eyes. He took issue with this statement. How do you figure that? He asked pointedly. Black people, Africans, had a long history before they got to this country. Mr. Kuhn, our history teacher, was unshaken. He continued. Black people were brought here as slaves and didn't really create history per se until the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s. Black people helped to build this country, Brad retorted. His voice was raised as he preached through the room. I didn't know who to believe. I'd never thought about it before. The only history I learned about black people up to that point was related to Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, and the famous March on Washington. I was scared for Brad. He, Annalisa Zavala, Arlene Lee Soy, and I were the only people of color in the advanced placement history class. Both Brad and Annalisa were new to the honors program. I had Spanish with Annalisa and knew she was smart. She belonged. After class, Brad tried to pull me to the side to explain his point of view and how he thought Mr. Kuhn was prejudiced against us. Don't you see it, he implored. He implored me. I did see it, but didn't want to admit it. Brad was making waves, and I didn't want any part of it. I knew what could happen to us, if we spoke up or out too loudly. For the rest of the class, and until Brad was tracked out after only 3 weeks, Mr. Kuhn ignored Brad's flailing hand. Annalisa left, too. She never spoke in class and always looked out of place. There was nothing I could do to help her. Before the first quarter was over, there was only two of us. Brad would not be in our history class to help us to untangle the Rodney King riots that occurred in the spring of 1992. King, a black man, was mercilessly beat by 4 white police officers while a dozen more watched, following a high-speed chase on the interstate. Although the incident was videotaped by a bystander and showed King being struck more than 50 times with batons, the officers were acquitted. During the trial, the video played on loop in most of the local news stations, and the beating was the talk of the community. When the riots broke out in L.A. following the verdict, the racial panic reached a distant school more than 100 miles away. Miss Craig locked our campus and declared a state of emergency. The fire alarm rang out, and we were told to stay in our respective classrooms. Now everyone be calm, Mr. Kuhn advised. No one's going to get hurt if we just stay put and wait to hear from Miss Craig. We'll leave when she tells us it's safe. Safe from whom, I wondered. As I scanned the room, the white kids looked anxious in need of definite reassurance that nothing would happen to them. After a few moments of silence, it finally dawned on me, safe from us. They were protecting the mostly white kids in the room from them, the black and Latino kids who might be upset by the verdict. In that moment, I felt like my skin did not belong in my body. I felt like an intruder, an outsider within. L.A. was burning. The neighborhoods I once walked and visited as a child was engulfed in flames, and no one was doing anything about it. On the television and in the newspaper, the residents were portrayed as savages and short-sighted for burning down their neighborhoods. The truth is that we were not allowed to go anywhere else. They were contained, an invisible fence around them. For fear they would be harmed, the police and paramedics were given orders to stay out of those areas. Mayor Tom Bradley called a National Guard on the fourth day of rioting only because the downtown Civic Center area was threatened. By then, billions of dollars in damage had been done and entire blocks had been reduced to rubble. The King verdict was preceded by the fatal shooting of Latasha Harlins, a 15-year-old black girl who was shot in the back of her head while buying a bottle of juice from a local corner store. The store owner, Sue Jaju, believing Harlins was attempting to steal the drink, had confronted her and a scuffle ensued. As Harlan turned to leave, she was shot. She died clutching 2 $1 bills, the money she intended to pay for the juice. Du was indicted on charge of first-degree murder but received only probation and a $500 fine. Following the verdict, the judge in the case noted that although Du had reacted inappropriately, her reaction was understandable. I suppose she meant that if the judge had, if she had been, I suppose she meant that if she, the judge, had found herself in a similar situation, she may have reacted the same way. The Rodney King Rice and the Latosha Harden's verdict represented the first time I attempted to place myself within a larger social context as both a black person and a girl. Latosha was only 1 year older than me. She was brown just like me, and she wore her hair like I sometimes wore mine. As a result, I felt vulnerable. At the time, I couldn't find anywhere in society or around me that said my life or what I became mattered, and the places and neighborhoods I called home were not worth protecting or saving. I was slowly coming to realize that the systems, structures, and institutions in our lives caused us more harm than good and were not designed to protect people like me.
Thank you. So we are running out of time, and I want to open up the floor to audience questions in a moment. So how about one last question? And I want to bring out how you've turned much of your, you know, adversity and challenges. And now, as an adult, for example, you mentioned that you were called difficult in classes, and you now embrace the term difficult. And that is now, and in your recent TED Talk, what you say is one of the keys to your success in escaping poverty. So I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about the power of being difficult to finish off.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk. I just need a sip. It's, you know, it's reading. It's just, you know, just takes all the. So one of the things I want to say about the passages specifically is that I chose those passages because I think they kind of juxtapose like little Nicole with, you know, my adult self and like the work that I do. And, seeing that there's still a little Nicole inside of me, and I carry her and the experiences of my community with me everywhere I go. So even when I'm, you know, in the room and representing, I'm very clear about who's in the room and what and the experiences I'm taking. And before I just want to say, before I talk about being difficult, one of the things that was really difficult in writing the book was that I felt like I wasn't just telling my story, but I was telling the story of my family and my mother. And my mother was the most difficult person for me to write about because it was very complicated. So she was a young mother, so she was 15 and really just very scrappy and doing what she could to take care of the two of us. And so making sure that I told her story as accurately as I could. And I remember the first draft I sent to the publisher, the first chapter, I was so mean to her in the first version. And the publisher, my editor, sent it back and she said, no, that's not the story you're trying to tell. You're not mad at her. You want to tell the broader story about why this has happened and why she is the way that she is. And then I had to go a little bit deeper. So in writing the story, in writing the book, in writing her story, in writing our story, I cried nearly every day, like literally, because some of the memories and, you know, and going back and even interviewing my mother and my best friend and my brother, hearing them tell their stories from their perspective. And sometimes I didn't agree. I said, well, I'm, you know, obviously I'm going to write the story. And I knew that I had to do their stories justice because they were not going to be able to write their own book. And so that was really important in terms of being able to tell the story. And one of the questions I always get, and even if you Google the book and read some of the comments that people say, they say, you know, well, you know, she's bullshit. I mean, she's saying it does, you know, like it takes more and that you have to have all these systems in place and you need to form systems and institutions. But look at her. She's an example. Like, she just proved her own theory wrong. You know, these people on, right. these trolls, you know. And you know, I just, I say, well, don't ask me how I did it. Say why, the question is why isn't the case that more people are right. doing it? And the thing that, getting to the question about being difficult, mm-hmm. I think that because the systems and structures are made up, and they're roadblocks, really, mm-hmm. and if you have to be really difficult and to ask for something that is not made for you, like mm-hmm. it wasn't designed for you. So the idea that there was nobody talking about college, and even when I talked to my counselor about going to college or to Howard specifically, he said, you know, I think you're just, that's just too much. You know, they turn away half, mm-hmm. more than half of the people who apply. But you go ahead and do it anyway. But, you know, what would it, you know. And so, you know, I said, okay, well, I'll do it. I'll do it anyways. And I think being told that there's a place for you and then saying, you know, I know that you say that there's this thing for me or this is, as far as I can go, but I'm going to do this other thing. You're difficult, and nobody likes to be perceived as difficult or an outsider. Mm-hmm. And so maybe last year somebody called me difficult, and then I cried, and I said, you know what? Actually, I may have to go ahead and embrace this as a gift. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to go ahead and turn this into a positive. And I think it was really that pushing back and being difficult and asking for more or saying, why can't I have this or mm-hmm. go here? Which I think that to the last thing I'll say is this thing about grit, right? So I don't know, there's all this conversation about if poor kids just have enough grit, that's what gets them out, you know, so just be gritty. And I said, well, you know, well, that's nice to say, in lieu of fixing everything else, you know, so mm-hmm. you just be gritty and you can, you know, overcome bad schools, you know, no grocery stores, no quality, you know, crime and all these things, and you just be gritty. But we don't require that kind of grit from any other group of kids. Mm-hmm. And so really challenging this idea about low-income kids need to be gritty, and they don't have the freedom to just be kids mm-hmm. and enjoy childhood, which, you know, the difference between seeing my kids and my child, like, it's night and day, and they just have the freedom to be kids and to play and to wonder and to think, and they have no idea about, you know, they have what it's like to not have. And I think that that's a gift of being a child, and it really makes me sad that all kids don't have that kind of freedom.
Thank you. Awesome. Thank you. So we'll open up to audience questions. Do you have one? Right.
Thank you, and thank you for being here. Going back to the beginning of your talk, you were talking about the Women's March and how the media mischaracterized it or mispresented it. And then also, can you talk about that in the context of how the president, the current president, has managed to bamboozle the media into not into twisting the story, into presenting things in a different way in terms of alternative facts, and what your thoughts are about the intersection of these issues?
I think that's really a good question. I think that in the blog today, I said, we have to trust our eyes and ears and believe what we're seeing and that it's the truth and believe what we're hearing because it's the truth. And I think we're dealing with a very slippery mm-hmm. Newly installed president. And I think the media has to do a better job at holding him accountable. And we also have to do a better job at holding the media accountable as well. Mm-hmm. I think that with the Women's March in particular, like when CNN calls, and she calls Karen, mm-hmm. and she says, you know, they say, hey, I want to talk about the march. Who should I talk to? I think it's on all of us to say, you know, you can talk to me, but you can also talk to Linda Sasseur. You can talk to Carmen Perez. you know, and mm-hmm. be that bridge, you know. And I think I saw an interview where Patricia Arquette actually tried to do that mm-hmm. and said, you know, I'm here, but there's some other people who should be here. And I thought that was a really good thing for her to try to do in that interview, even though he was like, whatever, you know, tell me more about mm-hmm. what you think. And so I just think taking those opportunities to be, you know, a real ally mm-hmm. And calling it out when it's missing, I think is good.
You said there were systems that impede people who are trying to better themselves. Can you give us some examples of what you mean by systems that impede?
So there are a lot. So the criminal legal system impedes. So the over-criminalization of Black and Brown people. So for example, there are many examples, but one example is, so for example, if you're in jail and you've been convicted and you have a felony on your record, in many states you can't get housing, you can't get financial aid for college. So even if you got out, you know, say you were a kid and you made a mistake, but it's a felony, that sticks with you for the rest of your life. You can't vote, so you're civically disenfranchised. And so that's what I mean by how a system that may be set up to help ends up hurting, whether it's intentionally or unintentionally. So that's one small example.
One last question.
Or the social welfare system is one of those mental health, you know.
What's one person or teacher who told you that you could go to college, that kept you there? A person that helped you to have the goal?
So thank you for setting up that wonderful question so I could talk about Ms. Bowman. So there was, in my old high school, so I left home at 17 to live with my paternal grandmother in Las Vegas. And so, but in California, there was a teacher who had a reputation for getting Black kids into college. And she's the one who told me to apply to Howard University. And I applied and I was accepted. And then I didn't have any money to go, you know, so I'd been accepted. And I was so happy that I got accepted. Somebody had to tell me that I had no money to go. And just very quick anecdote, she was in California, so I was calling her every day on the payphone across the street from my high school, because this is before cell phones, and she would not talk to me. She was busy because she was teaching. And I was so desperate because school was starting soon. I got on a Greyhound bus. I was supposed to be at school, got on a Greyhound bus back to my old high school, was there before the first bell rang, and I was standing in her doorway saying, you have to help me. I got accepted. I don't have any money. And she was obviously shocked to see me standing there. And she asked me to step out of the room and while she made a phone call. She called me back in about 20 minutes later, and she said, you know, you have a full merit scholarship to Howard University. And I literally hugged her, got back on the bus, and made it to, I worked at a food court casino, a food court in a casino, made it for my night shift. But it was her and that, obviously the dean on the other line, who gave me the scholarship. And so what was amazing was that, you know, again, being difficult. So he was saying no, but I was like, no, I'm going to figure this out. And again, I don't think that we're asking kids to do a lot. We're asking, mm-hmm. that's too much. You should not have to, you know, catch a bus 4 hours out of your way and you know, ditching school. I mean, I was supposed to be in school. You know, it shouldn't be that hard. And I think that's on the thing.
Yes, thank you. Well, thank you so much.
All right.
And I think that's, we've run out of time. The story of Miss Bowman is actually in the excerpt in the Ms. magazine that you have. And also, please stay and join us for a book signing right after this program. So thank you so much, everyone.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.